Next presenter is Dr. Denise Valente. Dr. Valente graduated from Oregon State University with a science degree and certificate in gerontology. Her residency was in low vision, followed by teaching positions in optometry. She investigates neurodegenerative diseases. She has published numerous articles, chapters, and books, and presented all over the United States and abroad on Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and the eye. She serves on review boards for ophthalmology and neurology journals and funding agencies and sits on NIH study sections. Dr. Valente.
As a segue into this talk, we heard about all the eye diseases that can impact an older person. However, many clinicians, when they do an eye exam, find odd findings, funky findings, strange visual fields and behaviors, and they've ruled out eye disease. So I'm going to present some information that is evolving, and some of what I'm going to present is relatively new, meaning in the last 10 years, about the visual system and Alzheimer's. What I want to point out is that I just have a very short time, and there is so much more out there in peer-reviewed publications and visual and Alzheimer's review papers. So if you have an interest in the topic or you're concerned about your patients, I would encourage you to download and read what's out there. I did include in the APHA handouts some one comprehensive paper and two research reports. However, since I did that, there's actually been additional papers that have come out. They're constantly coming out about the visual system and Alzheimer's. So this is by no means a very comprehensive lecture. Oh, well. I'm not looking at this. Where's the... Oh, just here?
Yeah, no.
And then to advance it, you do it there?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, that's fine.
All right. The actual disclosure about who helped finance some of my work is at the end. I'm not going to go into detail about the Alzheimer's disease itself. There are numerous organizations, both NIH and the Alzheimer's organization, that you can download and get information about demographics. But just briefly, Alzheimer's is a type of dementia that causes problems with memory, thinking, and behavior. It is the most common form of dementia, but it is not. It is not a normal part of aging. Unfortunately for Alzheimer's, there is no clear-cut test to diagnose it. There is no blood test. There is no MRI image. There is no tissue sample. Currently, the definitive diagnosis is made upon death with autopsy findings of the brain. Current tests, though, to screen for this and come up with a presumptive Alzheimer's diagnosis are currently based on behavioral neuropsychological testing. However, there is advancing research on imaging, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the imaging through the eye, genetic testing, blood, and other fluid tissues. The risk factors for Alzheimer's disease: age, family history, risk genes, and one that people are hearing a lot about is the trauma. Now, there have been numerous, because it is a timely topic and it's an interesting topic to a lot of discussions about head injury and the development of a neurodegenerative disease. Football is just one example of how it's a complex question. Because there are a lot of factors that go into what person may get a neurodegenerative disease and who may not. And football, because it's been in the media a lot, is just an example. Because while there is a higher rate of Alzheimer's, there is also issues and discussions of other types of brain pathology that may not have been the football alone. It may have been a combination of football, lifestyle, and things that a football player may do that's a professional that another football player may not do, such as PEDs. However, what is becoming clear is you only have so much brain tissue. If some of it's damaged, for whatever reason, you have less reserves if your body is going to go on and have a neurodegenerative processes. We learn that with glaucoma. You can lose a lot of your cells and axons, but there is a point where you start to lose function because you just don't have enough to handle the load of the function it's supposed to be. And that's the same thing with the brain. So if an injury has caused you to lose some of your structure, some of your cells, some of your axons, not only may you theoretically be vulnerable to a neurodegenerative disease such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, but you also just don't have the reserves that if you hadn't played football, you may have expressed the disease later. What they have found in studies outside of the one that you're hearing the most about on the media and that was on television a couple weeks ago is that, yes, in fact, there's a higher rate of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's among those that have played professional football. But they also found that if you played professional football, you lived longer. So there's a lot of variables there. Visual functions that are known to be affected by Alzheimer's disease. First of all, you retain good acuity if your only pathology is Alzheimer's disease. So 20/20, in the absence of any other pathology, if you have an eye pathology, you're potentially not going to be 20/20. If all you have is Alzheimer's and nothing else, you're going to be 20/20. Something else is going to potentially be causing that cataract, macular degeneration, and all the things that go along with normal aging. However, what does get affected is the processes that aren't in the part of the brain that process precise images. Contrast sensitivity, visual fields, motion, glare, light-dark adaptation, and circadian functions. The reason for this is that the retina is a direct extension of the brain, and a very large part of the brain, throughout the entire brain, has in some way a role in processing visual images. The pathway is to get 20/20 is fairly direct. It goes from the eye into the optic nerve. A major relay station, the lateral geniculate nucleus, and then it goes into the part of the brain that allows you to see precise vision, 20/20. However, vision, and when it's integrated with other systems, goes in a lot of other places. And what I'm going to talk about today is some of the lateral processing structures of the brain. Because before we get to that, there are changes in the brain with the pathology upon autopsy that are directly in major vision areas. I showed you the LGN. Well, what they found in Alzheimer's, this is not a photo of Alzheimer's, but they're in the layers here of the LGN, which is a very small structure, they find deposits of amyloid and tau. So if in the major relay portion of the brain there's the pathology, it's going to in some way impact visual functions. Not necessarily acuity, but visual functions. However, a more vulnerable area is an area, visual association area 19, Brodmann's area. This particular part of the brain is not necessarily what processes precise vision, but integrates what you see into other functions. And it also processes and sends it to other parts of the body for seamless integration. And I'll show you a little bit more. The interesting thing about this area is there was a single paper that came out that looked at that area. And they concluded, and I'll explain why they did, that that may be the very first area that is impacted by Alzheimer's disease. And it may actually be impacted before memory. Now, the author of that paper is McGee, and obviously she didn't do it by herself, but there's a variety of authors, and it came out in 2006. What they looked at, and McGee looks at all the brain tissue from the Framingham Heart Study, her and her team. What they found that in 52% of those that did not have cognitive issues, did not have dementia, had no reported memory problems, that 52% of those folks had amyloid tau type pathology in the visual association area. And some of those folks had no pathology in the memory processing areas. However, they also found 100% of those that did have dementia had Alzheimer's type pathology in the visual association area. The conclusion was that the visual association area may be the very first area impacted by Alzheimer's disease-related pathology, even earlier than those areas processing memory in the hippocampal area. So it makes sense that if the cell here not necessarily back here, but here, the axon's going back to the eye. If those cells are dying or dead, those axons would be deficit. And how we measure axons within the eye itself, and I'll explain a little bit of that, would pick up that deficit. Now, why haven't you necessarily heard about this if this was such a remarkable finding? Why didn't this group continue that? The reason, I think, is they're also the group that you hear about and read about that looked at the brains from the professional football players. So you go where there is interest, you go where there's funding, and so they actually gained a lot of success in their lab and were able to fund their lab with other types of research. I'm going to go back. We're going to look closely again at the visual association area because that's an area that processes motion or part of the processing of motion. And it's again, that's one area I was talking about. The reason that's interesting and of relevance in Alzheimer's is, while it's not true motion, when we test vision with a flicker type target, that's the area of the brain that may be processing it. I'm loosely defining some of these things so that you can look at the clinical relevance, but flicker is a target, a light, a flash of light that turns on and off with a distinct rhythm. Flicker tests can vary how they're administered. You may have it start real slow and then get quick, and then the person reports when they no longer see it. Or it can start real fast and then gradually slow, and they'll tell you when they first see it. Now, again, a loose definition, some of the tests that are used for developing children or those with cognitive impairment are alternating stripes or alternating checkerboards. That's a, in my loose definition, that's a type of flicker target. Well, there was an Alzheimer's study with MRI where they looked at a flicker study. Now, what they looked at was normal Alzheimer's disease and mild cognitive impairment, MCI. MCI is considered diagnostically the precursor to full-blown Alzheimer's. It was a target that was a checkerboard that alternated. And what they did in the MRI, a functional test of MRI, they gradually increased the rate of flicker. A functional MRI doesn't actually test the brain function, but what it does is it looks at the amount of blood flow. So the better the function, the more the blood flow might be. So they looked at normal, mild, and moderate Alzheimer's, and what they found is the faster the flicker, the more difficulty both mild Alzheimer's and moderate Alzheimer's had in this test. And here's just the graphical depiction of that. What their flicker, where they stopped, was at 15 hertz. But you can see the top line is normal. But as you go down, the mild had some difficulty, and the diagnosed moderate Alzheimer's, which is a more severe, had even more difficulty. Well, there's a clinical parallel to that type of testing that's used for diabetes and glaucoma and to just generally look at eye disease in general. It's a visual field test. But instead of a flash of light as you test your peripheral vision, there are two different tests that actually have a striped target. One of the ones that has a published paper on is matrix frequency doubling technology. It is a small 5-degree target, and it flickers at 18 hertz. The publication looked at even a more cut, a more broke down population. They looked at Alzheimer's disease, MCI, and then they included a category that we don't often see is they just had memory complaints and then normal. Now, if you look at this particular paper, while it's not what we like to see or hear, but happens frequently in Alzheimer's research, they only have a population of 10. That is very common in Alzheimer's research. As common as the disease is, it's very, 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 very difficult to get subjects. One of the reasons is caregiver burden. It's not going to benefit the patient, so they're really going to be reluctant to take the time and energy. It's very intriguing to me, having done Parkinson's and Alzheimer's research. It's very easy to get Parkinson's subjects, but it's very difficult to get Alzheimer's. So you tend to see very small ends. So it's difficult to draw gross, generalized conclusions. I do that anyway. One of the things it did have in this paper that I'm not comfortable with, and I think it's because it wasn't necessarily an eye person that did some of the analysis, they didn't control for errors, meaning with the machine. Well, on the other hand, if they did, their N is 10. An Alzheimer's tends to have a lot of errors, false positives, false negatives, and fixation losses. So they might have had to cut their population down to 5. But it's a very difficult thing. I do think the difference between the Alzheimer's and the MCI would have been reduced had they controlled for errors. However, they did fully control for pathology, and they did discuss controlling for errors and not controlling for errors within the paper, so at least they acknowledged that it wasn't ideal. Now, I have done a paper, but it was a different technology. The reason for that is it's just a heck of a lot easier for an Alzheimer's patient subject to perform this particular test than the other, and I think because it flickers faster, it may not be as specific, but it may be more sensitive. This is the target. This is what the test, it only has, the reason it's easier is it has 17 areas and it's a slightly larger target. This is a lot of information you don't necessarily have to look at, but you can see how many subjects I had to get an N of 10, because I had to eliminate all the pathology, and then I had to exclude all the errors. And I had a conventional error exclusion. I didn't raise the bar just to get more subjects. But we still, once we did that, we found this particular protocol. It was a screening protocol. I wasn't trying to determine whether or not they had Alzheimer's. I just wanted to know, is Alzheimer's influencing the outcome of whether or not they pass or fail the test? So once we excluded pathology, eye pathology, and once we excluded unreliable test, it remained significant. Now, this particular test has its own age normative database. So once I got into that, I actually age matched everybody and still remained significant. So what the conclusion I draw with that particular test is, if you're using it at a large scale screening test and they miss, you have to determine whether or not there's an eye pathology. I did that ahead of time just for this project. However, once you rule out eye pathology, you may have a neurologic deficit of some sort. So the next thing to think about is maybe you need to talk to their primary care physician or a neurologist. Now, there's even more data out there on the correlate, the matching. That doesn't help. I have heart failure, and it actually makes it worse, and you don't want to see the unpleasant behaviors that can occur. It just comes up. It's like a volcano. When you have a visual field loss, and this just shows in the red, that's the side vision test, there's a correlate structurally that is not a subjective test, it's objective. And that's what's hitting the literature. There are at least 15 papers about the imaging of the retina with newer technology. This finding here on top is a typical Alzheimer's finding. They tend to miss, in my data points, my data set, inferiorly. So when I have done an OCT on them, I'm curious to see if there's a matching correlate of structure that's superior. And this is the instrument. This is an older technology that I used in my work. There's much better technology out, and I'll demonstrate that in a minute. I have this slide so that it's easier to read what I'm doing later. When an OCT takes the nerve fiber layer, which is the part, the axon that went from your brain to the retina, when it measures it, it actually takes a slice like a cookie cutter, so it's the edge of the cookie cutter. And then the graph lays it out like this. And this is, I'm just attempting to show that so you can look at this. This is a normal depiction of a nerve fiber layer, and this material depicted here is what's the nerve fiber layer. And these are just, this is a publication that shows that this is a Alzheimer's patient and there was a difference significant, this is one subject, this was a case, this wasn't a study, between the Alzheimer's and a control. There are now many, many, at least 15 papers on Alzheimer's and this imaging technology. This is not optic nerve fiber layer, but this is a paper that just came out because it seems like every other month there's a new paper that showed a difference between normal and Alzheimer's. And this newer technology that this paper was is very, very exquisite in how it shows the retina. Now, we're going to go fast forward because this is just some clinical information. There's a literature out there that says there's a higher rate of glaucoma among those with Alzheimer's. Now, what becomes difficult once they have Alzheimer's, you can't necessarily do a visual field. So whether or not there's a higher rate gets to be confusing, and it's not clear. There's no clear-cut answer because some of the papers are showing no. For those of you that have been active for quite a while in the APHA, this is Dr. Ingram. I was looking for, and I think I missed his name, I was looking for pictures of house calls, and I found this, and I was quite intrigued by it. Alzheimer's drugs impact the eye. The most common category of Alzheimer's medication are cholinesterase inhibitors. The more common one is Aricept donepezil. What it does is it acts on the pupil and the iris, and there is a paper out there that says it does increase outflow. Now, that's something to be sensitive to because, again, if glaucoma is a risk, the drug may artificially be dropping, will be dropping the pressure a little bit and you're not aware of it. So that's something as a person who's trying to make a clinical decision how to manage a patient. I know, almost out of time. The other thing that the reason it drops the pressure is the medication constricts the pupil. It pulls on the ciliary body and it opens up the drainage channel. Now, there's another impact that any clinician needs to be aware of when it comes to their Alzheimer's patient that the drugs can also impact. If there's a sudden cessation of the drug, of the medication, for example, somebody went into the hospital, there can be episodes of acute angle closure. What does that mean? It means that pupil that was normally, say this is the center of your pupil and your iris is here, is all of a sudden open and maybe blocking the drainage area. There weren't all that many reports. It is out in the literature of this happening. However, about a year ago, the FDA approved dose of Aricept donepezil doubled. So if there was a minor risk before, that risk has increased somewhat. The other thing that is important is if a person with Alzheimer's is going in for cataract surgery, the surgeon needs to be sensitive to that there can be a risk for what's called interoperative floppy iris. And what happens is the cells have been inundated for quite some time with that medication to make the pupil constricted. Well, they'll put a drop in to make it surgery easier to open up the pupil and they have a better field to work within. But the dilating drops can wear off much quicker. And right in the middle of surgery, what can happen is that pupil can come down. And so what's recommended if a patient has been on Aricept for a long time is they have the tools in the operating room, the speculum-type tools to hold the pupil open mechanically. I hope I've made it clear that anybody that works in the field of vision care is in a position to start to assist with identifying and potentially even managing this tsunami of Alzheimer's that's going to be affecting us. What do you do? Well, some of the things I pointed out, a lot of clinicians already do in their normal day-to-day activities in working with a patient, visual fields. A lot of clinicians have this technology. So it's something to just look at it a little differently if you have an older patient, even if they're not diagnosed with Alzheimer's, to start to help and have conversations with the primary care. But as you can see, there's a lot we don't know. And this is, over the years, I've had a variety of funding for some of this work.